fear of being left behind. If a student has talent, they need inspiration, not rigid rules. Draw the finger like this and the torso like this. Mr. Zakarian's mimicry drew laughter. You must admit that classical techniques ought to be mastered first. Can you at least admit that? Mr. Zakarian relented.
We agree on that point. But if my student wants to draw a fish on the head of his figure, why shouldn't he?
As they railed back and forth, the students breaking out into smaller arguments among themselves, Clara leaned against the wall. She had nothing to add. The hierarchy in the art world had been established hundreds of years ago. Oil painting trumped watercolors, portraits trumped landscapes. And all of that, summed up as fine art, trumped commercial art. Illustrators lay at the very bottom of the totem pole. Mr. Zakarian had probably invited her along to show her how little her tantrum mattered in the rarefied world of high art.
"You must declare your affiliation and stand by it," said Mr. Standish. "Academic art has been around for far longer than your cubist goulash. In 100 years, it will still be the standard-bearer for great art."
One of Mr. Zakarian's students chimed in.
"You don't understand how fast the world is changing. Pretty pictures are no longer of interest, except to stodgy collectors."
Back in Arizona, taking classes at her provincial art school, Clara dreamed of meeting other artists. No one in her family understood her passion for drawing. How sometimes at night she'd lie awake, thinking about the line of a cheekbone on a portrait she'd been struggling with, imagining the exact brushstroke she'd use the next day. But this discussion, if you could call it that, was far beyond anything she'd been taught. She didn't have the vocabulary to join in, even if she wanted to. A part of her knew this was why she'd kept to herself this past year. Everyone else in New York was so polished. She was not. Her family hailing from hardscrabble stock who endured the blistering heat of desert summers. But even if she didn't speak like they did, her confidence and passion in her own work were unwavering. When she drew or painted, it was as if an unseen hand guided her own. She'd never been able to explain that to anyone. To her, painting was an internal expression, not a political or social one. She didn't have a manifesto or an affiliation other than to please herself doing what she loved to do and make money doing it. The first part was easy, the second, more elusive.
"Picabia is no better than an illustrator."
The speaker was Nadine. Her friendly smile from earlier that evening had disappeared. Mr. Zakarian's gaze swung Clara's way like a lighthouse beacon.
"An interesting supposition, Nadine. Luckily, we have a distinguished illustrator here. Perhaps Miss Darden has something to say in her own defense?"
Clara was only vaguely familiar with Picabia's early drawings of machines, which resembled instruction manuals and were of no interest to her. But that wasn't the point here, and Levon knew it. He was challenging her to prove herself. Her heart pounding at the attention, she went on the attack. "I assume you rarely have illustrators join in your cozy after-hours gatherings, but my guess is that's because illustration requires both talent and discipline, which in turn requires honing your craft instead of staying up all night talking about it."
Mr. Zakarian grinned.
Her audacity seemed to please him.
"You can only work so many hours in a day. If you don't know why you're working, what's the point?"
"I know exactly why I'm working. To please the client. Illustrators have to be malleable experts at all styles and subjects." The silence that followed only fed her disdain. She wouldn't be working at the school much longer anyway, so what did it matter? I'd like to see you get a commission, figure out the approach and execution, then do it all over again the next day, with a different client, with a different set of expectations. You wouldn't last a week.
Fine. It's a tough field, said the student, sitting to Mr. Zakarian's right. But you can't call it art. It's a magazine cover or an ad, and then it's trash.
She stood firm. One day, illustrations will be as venerated as the works of Matisse. Mr. Zakarian laughed.
So you're saying that one day an ad for pea soup will be framed and hanging on the wall of a museum?
Maybe. What I'm saying is that many illustrators are more proficient, more skilled than fine artists.
Let's prove it. I dare you to come to my life drawing and painting class tomorrow.
Mr. Zakarian's words had an edge that belied the smile on his face. Mr. Zakarian had no idea whom he was dealing with. Clara had been born into a family of great wealth and indulgence in Phoenix, and she vividly remembered screaming as a child of three when her mother refused her a sweet. Her father had adored her ferocity, encouraged it. When his embezzlement scheme, selling shares in a copper mine that never existed, finally unraveled, it had only made Clara more demanding. For 15 years, the world had revolved around her, and then suddenly she was an afterthought, her tyrannical ways no longer effective at getting attention or a pleasing response. But she could summon up the familiar fury at a moment's notice if necessary. I'd be delighted. The students cheered, or more accurately, jeered. She'd show them. In return, you can come to my class and spend a day as an illustrator. Mr. Zakarian rubbed his mustache with his hand in what she suspected was an effort to hide his amused surprise.
Very well. We'll see who is the better artist, then.
We certainly will.
What will be the wager?
The answer came to her in a flash. A way to make up for the dismal evening, even if it meant laying bare her vulnerability before everyone. If I win, you must speak with Mr. Lorette and convince him to keep me on next term.
Do you think I have that kind of pull?
I do.
Very well, then. He paused. And if I win, I get the opportunity to paint you.
Someone let out a low whistle. She ignored it, as well as the insinuation of his wanting her to be his model. Everyone knew what he meant, and she noticed the muscles in Nadine's neck twitch. She nodded. Very well. Out on the sidewalk, Clara took a moment to get her bearings. Even this late at night, the narrow Greenwich Village street was punctuated with people who seemed to be in no rush to get home. A couple linked at the arms brushed by her as if she wasn't even there, the woman laughing loudly at something the man said. She watched them walk away, their movements slightly off, as if they were walking on a ship's deck, a sure sign that they'd visited one of the many speakeasies tucked under stoops and in back courtyards. The door to the restaurant opened, and Mr. Zakarian flew out, followed closely by Nadine.
You're leaving?
Nadine's voice was short and sharp, a recrimination. Mr. Zakarian threw Clara an apologetic look and held up one finger before turning back to the girl. If God created a woman who was the exact opposite of Clara, Nadine would be the result. Short, with a stocky build, full bosom, and thick black hair, she was of the ground, of the earth, in spite of her fashionable clothes and well-bred airs. Nadine put her hands on her hips and glowered up at Mr. Zakarian.
You're going with her?
I'm planning on discussing the school with another faculty member. You don't need to be jealous.
Clara had no desire to get involved in the drama of a lecherous teacher and his needy student. I don't need an escort home. Thank you very much. She headed east at a good clip. Only 10 seconds passed before she heard Mr. Zakarian's footsteps. He pulled up beside her as she reached the next intersection.
Sorry about that, but I did want to speak with you further. First, I want to apologize for putting you on the spot like that.
I rather enjoy watching spoiled young artists declare their manifestos. If only we could all meet again in 3 years when they realize what a pointless enterprise it was, and that the time would have been better spent in the studio, Mr. Zakarian.
Please, call me Lavon.
His dark eyes sparkled in the lamplight.
I agree, although I admit that I do my share of declaring. Isn't it a good idea to have a sense of what you want to accomplish?
She stopped walking. I have had a very long day, and the last thing I wish to do is continue on with that ridiculous conversation. We have drawn our lines in the sand, and I look forward to taking your class. But for now, I must get home and finish up my commissions so that I can afford to buy more paint. He joined her again, loping along like a Saint Bernard.
Just take it from the teacher's supply closet. They'll never know. I do it all the time.
She could only imagine the glee in Mr. Lorette's eyes, catching her with a satchel full of purloined paints. Mr. Lorette may give you that liberty, but he wouldn't do the same for me. You really ought to go back to your audience.
Nah, they're probably still torturing Sebastian.
They fell into step together. Like her, he took long strides.
I have students who love me and those who hate me, but the past few years teaching, I've earned my audience. I suspect you'll have your own group of fawning students before the semester is out. Part of the job.
Speaking of fawns, how old is Nadine? He had the decency to look abashed.
Just turned 19.
And how old are you?
25.
She'd figured he was over 30. Oh, so am I. Her assessment of his talents reordered themselves. At 25, he was still new on the scene. The show, earlier this evening, was probably as important to him as it was to her. Did you get any interest tonight?
Who knows? Who cares?
His voice rose, the questions quivering in the cold night air. He did care. She refused to soften. What are your ambitions, then, if you don't care?
To change the way people look at the world.
She tried not to laugh, but he caught her smirking.
Don't make fun of me. I bet you feel the same way.
He carried on.
But your idea of changing the world is to have someone buy a product. A dress, or a hat, or a can of soup, no?
His naivete rankled her. You'd like them to buy your painting. Is that any different?
Of course it is. Because they will buy their soup and take it home and eat it, while my work will hang on their walls and give them joy for years.
Or no one will buy it, and it'll languish in your studio, because there are 100 other artists who are trying to do what you do. He stopped walking.
What is it that I do?
Draw like Picasso. She couldn't help herself. The works she'd seen on the walls of the Grand Central Art Galleries signed by Lavon Zakarian were far too similar to those of the Spanish genius.
Why not? He's the greatest painter of our time. What is wrong with paying homage to him?
Nothing at all. But if someone wants a Picasso, they can buy one. She waited for a retort, but none came.
I want to show you something.
Now?
Yes. My studio isn't far from here, right off Union Square. Will you come with me?
She studied him. Lavon was almost giddy, like a child on Christmas Eve. But he wasn't attracted to her, she was sure of that. Aside from her brief frisson with Oliver earlier that evening, Most men weren't. And it didn't bother her much now that she was away from her mother's heaving sighs of disappointment. In this case, it was a relief, as she was curious to see his studio, and the wager to paint her while bold was probably the best he could come up with under the circumstances. Levon led her into a building on the north side of 16th Street. They trudged up several sets of stairs and down a long, dark hallway to the door at the very end. Levon's studio, to her shock, was as clean as a hospital. The parquet floor had been newly scrubbed. Two massive easels stood in the middle of the floor, the center of attention, while jars of brushes and paint cans lined a windowsill like a row of inert spectators. A bank of leaded windows slanted down on the north side, where a daybed and a large dining room table had been shoved aside, the furniture merely an afterthought. Clara shrugged off her coat and wandered over to a bookshelf near the fireplace, trying not to appear too impressed. Levon had obviously done well to be able to afford such a massive studio. He was probably subsidizing his salary from the art school with private lessons. How easy it was for him to have come to New York and found respect, a steady income, and an enormous place to work. Levon lit the burner under a kettle on the small kitchen stove. Would you like some tea?
No, thank you.
She paged through a volume on Matisse before placing it back on a different shelf. Levon opened his mouth to say something, but busied himself with his tea preparations instead. He was so easily provoked. For a moment, she regretted teasing him. Any artist who so tightly controlled his studio, the alphabetized books, carefully spaced jars and scrubbed floors, was trying to keep something else in check. And she wondered what it could be. Eventually, he approached one of the easels and gently lifted the dust cloth from it.
"I'd like you to see this, Miss Darden."
She waved one hand at him. "Please, call me Clara." He gave her a solemn nod and stepped back, offering her the prime spot in front of it. She'd expected another wild, Picasso-like flight of fancy, not a portrait. Two figures looked out from the canvas, a boy holding something in one hand, standing beside a seated woman whose gaze was as dark as death. A boy and his mother. The boy had a dark mess of hair and the same pointed widow's peak as Levon's. He wore a yellow overcoat and a funny set of slipper-like shoes, his feet turned slightly away, as if he hoped to escape as soon as possible. The woman, though, was solid, unmoving, going nowhere. Her hands rested on her knees but appeared unfinished, as if she were wearing mittens. The lack of detail existed only from the neck down, however, as her face had been drawn in with an elegant line from eyebrow to nose, heavily lidded eyes, encircled by an ocean blue headscarf. The boy, unsure and self-conscious, was turned in on himself, while the woman's energy was directed outward at the viewer, accusatory yet hopeful. "This is you and your mother," he nodded. "It's beautiful. Heartbreaking, Levon. Why didn't you show this tonight?" He pulled the cloth back over it.
"It's not finished."
On a table nearby, she spotted a photograph. "Is that what you're working from?" He snatched it up and stared at it for a couple of seconds before reluctantly passing it over. Clara held it carefully at the very edges. The same figures, but filled with details. The woman's hands had thick working-class fingers. The boy held a small bouquet of flowers. The boy looked more certain, and the woman less so. "Tell me the story behind this." Levon prowled away from her, then back.
"My father was a cobbler," He came to the United States from the shores of Lake Van in Turkish Armenia. He was going to send for my mother, sister, and me once he was settled. While we waited, my mother had this photo taken in the hopes that he wouldn't forget us.
Why wasn't your sister in the photograph?
Girls were not as important. I was the boy, his son. My mother hoped it would remind him of his duties.
I see.
But before we could send it to him, we were forced out by the threat of a civil war and headed east. My sister wore boys' clothes for safety's sake, and together we made it to a city called Yerevan, where we lived in an abandoned building. If it rained, we got wet, and we tried to make do, but it was very difficult to find food.
As he spoke, he circled the entire room several times. Clara stayed still as he grew more and more agitated.
My mother became ill, and one day she died. She'd given all her food to us, and we'd eaten it. Taken her life. We were selfish.
The day's complaints and petty jealousies fell away. She would have wanted to feed you first. Any mother would have. When did you come to the States?
Soon after. As orphans, we were bumped up to the top of the list. We lived with relatives in Providence, and I never did find my father. Never cared to. Our relatives said he'd taken up with another woman and moved away. I drew, went to art school there, and then came here. I studied at the Grand Central School of Art and became a teacher within months.
The return of his bravado cheered Clara. Of course you did. This painting is remarkable. You must continue.
You must as well.
How can you say that when you've never even seen my work?
I can see in you that you are like me. Strong. I must give you my advice, though.
Okay.
Get out more. Don't sit in your studio all day. It's not good for the soul. Also, don't let your students come first. Your work comes first, always.
I'll do my best.
And when you come to my class, don't worry if you don't do very well. These students, my students, are trained by the very best. Me.
And the pomposity was back with a vengeance. I'll see you tomorrow at 10. As she left, she saw him reach for the mop leaning against the wall. His voice, singing some kind of folk song in a foreign tongue, rang down the stairwell. She imagined him mopping away their footprints, scrubbing away his sad tail well into the night. Chapter 4, April 1928. Clara walked into Levon's studio at the Grand Central School of Art 10 minutes early. She'd woken with a burst of nervous energy and wanted to get this ridiculous bed over with. If she was going to make a fool of herself in a room full of his students, so be it. She'd torture him in her own class. Although, looking around the studio, she saw that her humiliation would take place in front of 4 times as many onlookers. Levon's class was held in one of the biggest studios in the school, a testament to his popularity. A couple of dozen easels encircled the model's platform in the middle of the room. Nadine, as class monitor, directed Clara to an easel in the front row, with a scowl. Levon wants you here.
Clara shrugged off the girl's rudeness and busied herself with organizing her brushes and paint. She'd loved everything about being in a studio ever since she'd attended her first art class several years earlier. The sharp tang of turpentine, the oily residue of paint on a palette, and even the scuffed-up floors awed her. You never knew what might come to pass after 4 hours of diligent concentration. A work of art, or a canvas, to be scraped and reused for next time. Soon after her family had fled to Tucson, she read about a new art school in the newspaper. Located in an abandoned factory just outside of town, where every summer monsoon rains pounded the shellacked earth, the school attracted a fair bit of notice, and Clara begged her father for permission to go. She'd filled notebooks with silly doodlings as a young girl, and later, when the family's fortunes fell, the act of drawing had become an escape of sorts. Her father allowed her to go to one class. That was all they could afford. But the director, Miss Alice, recognized her talent and allowed her to come back whenever she liked. Miss Alice taught her to be quiet for a moment before putting brush or pencil to paper, to wait and listen to the voice in her head before beginning. Once Clara discovered her passion for art, there was no going back. She was determined to make it her career, her life. Levon entered in a rush, shouting out for Nadine. She leaped forward and took his coat, hanging it on the rack near the door. Levon looked about.
"Where's our model? Not here yet. Well, let's not fret about that."
Levon stopped in front of Clara, blinked a couple of times, and moved on. She was relieved he didn't call attention to her. Being parked in the front of the room was bad enough. For 5 minutes, Levon spoke in a torrent of ideas, touching upon the best works to view in the Met and Gallatin's Gallery of Living Art of Cézanne, Picasso, and Braque. He called on students to offer their opinions before shredding them to pieces. What had she been thinking? This was no painting class. It was a cult. The students appeared to enjoy the show. Several tried to offer counterpoints, and Levon prodded them into expanding on their ideas before shooting them down, always with a smile on his face. The door opened, and the robed model walked in. Usually, the men and women who got paid to pose were on the far side of desperate, washed-up dancers or actors with folds of flesh that spoke of indulgence or limbs bony with age. Last year, as a student at the school, Clara had quickly gotten over the shock of a nude man or woman posing for class. The challenge of capturing a sagging breast or rounded buttock on paper or canvas quickly overtook the embarrassment of gawking at a naked human being. But this wasn't a down-on-his-luck stranger. It was Oliver, the poet from the restaurant. As Oliver's robe fell to the floor and he stepped onto the platform, a collective hush fell around the room. Every line of his body, the one that ran above his hip, the one that differentiated the long muscles of his thigh, resembled those of the antique casts that stared down at them from the studio's shelves. She caught Levon watching her and looked at her canvas, unsure of where to begin, overwhelmed. She wasn't the only one. A couple of the women gaped openly, which made her smile. Back to the work at hand. She had a bet to win, and she wasn't about to let a swell-looking fellow throw her off balance.
"Don't be bound by what you see," said Levon.
He came to a stop beside Oliver, who stood with his arms crossed, as if waiting for a bus. Levon whispered something, and he struck a pose, shifting his weight on the left leg, a hand on his hip, his eyes looking up and out. Levon nodded and addressed the class.
"I want you to sketch what you feel."
Clara had to bite her cheek to keep from smiling at the vagueness of his words, so typical of pompous art teachers. Imagine if she said such a thing to her illustration class. They'd have looked at her as if she had two heads. All around her, the students dove in, knowing that time was limited and eager to please their master. As they worked, Levon drifted from easel to easel. He stared for a long time at the canvas of a young woman at the end of Clara's row.
You're trying to be clever again, and I don't want that. I must break you of that habit. For the next class, when we turn to oils, I want you to use a large brush for the details and a small brush for the fill.
He moved down another easel, to a young man whose hand was wildly moving about the paper. Levon took the pencil from him.
Permit me.
Clara stifled a gasp as he drew over the student's work. His arrogance astounded her. She sharpened her pencil, the sound like a low rumble in the quiet room, and immediately regretted calling attention to herself. Levon was getting closer. He looked over and flashed a big smile her way, stuck his thumb up in the air like a clown. She should never have agreed to this. She'd placed herself at a disadvantage, and by failing here, she'd further erode what was left of her standing in the school. Clara looked at her own blank canvas, then back up at the model, only to discover he was looking right at her. She was the only one not doing anything, frozen in place. He winked at her, and reflexively, she smiled back. Levon shouted at a skinny boy to her right.
No, no. You have to consider the negative space. Stupid, stupid.
He was closing in. One thing was certain. If he dared to draw on her canvas, she'd pick it up and smash it over his head. Clara remembered her father, who'd taken to belittling Clara and her mother once his fortunes fell, as if their reduced circumstances were their fault. He went out very little, other than to his menial job at a hospital, while Clara's mother took over all the tasks the servants had done in Phoenix, cooking and cleaning and polishing his shoes. Clara watched with horror and revulsion as her mother kowtowed to his every need, doing whatever it took to diffuse his foul moods, often making them worse in the process. Levon was similar in temperament. His impetuousness, the cavalier disregard for everyone around him, his certainty in his own talents. She had to put him straight. Let him know that she was not to be bullied. No doubt, if she didn't do well under this ridiculous test, he'd lose interest in her. For some strange reason, the thought annoyed her even more. She took a deep breath, reminding herself that she was a teacher, not a frightened pupil. When one of her own students seemed stuck, she'd tell them to stop believing that everything they did was precious. If you want to make a living at it, she'd say, you must sit at the drawing board, brush in hand, and simply do it. She put the pencil to the paper and began sketching out the proportions, the same as she would approach a Wanamaker drawing. The boy was so angelic, the line of his limbs so much the ideal that before she knew it, the figure on the canvas was almost completed. What a relief not to worry about the correct drape of a coat or the texture of a pair of pants. This was simply skin, bones, and musculature. Once she was satisfied with the outline, she picked up the palette and began experimenting with the oils. While watercolors were her favorite medium, oils came in a close second. She'd stepped in as a teacher for Miss Alice every so often after a couple of years of study, and she relished the challenge, switching from oils to watercolors to etching. She gave all her earnings to her father, which only seemed to make matters worse, adding to his humiliation. When she showed up at art class with a bruised wrist after one of their arguments, Miss Alice insisted she apply for a scholarship at the Grand Central School of Art in New York City. Together, they selected her best work and sent it off in the post. The letter of acceptance arrived a month later. It was only for one term. After that, she'd be on her own, but Clara jumped at the chance. Her father had railed at her for trying to sneak away, but she was certain he was secretly pleased to get rid of her. Her mother was openly relieved, as it meant one less person to provoke him.
"You'll never make it there,"
he said over her last dinner at home, a measly meal of stringy, overcooked chicken and some kind of mashed vegetables. Her mother knew she couldn't compete with the lavish dinners of their former cook, and she didn't bother to try.
"Why shouldn't I?"
"Because you're a girl and you're a dilettante. That city will devour you."
She'd arrived in New York on a bright September day, still reeling from the train trip, where she'd learned to carry a book whenever she got up from her seat, the better to fend off the advances of male passengers who took advantage of any sudden lurch for a quick grope. A hard bonk ensured they behaved better the next time they passed each other in the aisle. Grateful to finally be discharged from the claustrophobic train cars, she'd found her way to the door of a small apartment building on East 10th Street that leased rooms only to women. The landlord had shown her to the top floor, her very own studio, and Clara almost danced with joy. She began her illustration class the next day with Mr. Wendell, who was kind but bland. She learned later he was ill, which explained his hacking cough and lack of enthusiasm. For the first 3 weeks, he insisted the entire class draw shoes. Over and over, Mary Janes, Oxfords, satin slippers, and mules, followed by men's leather dress shoes. At night, Clara dreamed of soles and laces. She did as she was told, and was made monitor of the class, which made the other students jealous, but she didn't care. Armed with her drawings and desperate for rent money, Clara made the rounds of the magazines and big department stores, and Wanamaker had immediately assigned her to do an advertisement for children's shoes. Unlike the other less ambitious students, the ones who were unsure of their work and required Mr. Wendell's constant hand-holding, Clara had one goal: to make money off her art and prove her father wrong. As the fall wore on, New York grew colder and wetter. The tree outside her apartment scraped its stripped branches against the dull stone walls. Christmas Day, she spent alone in her studio drawing gloves, a step up from footwear, or so the advertising executive told her, and made just enough to pay for the next semester's classes. In January, when Mr. Wendell didn't show up to class, she offered to fill in, citing her experience in Arizona and her commissions from Wanamaker. Mr. Lorette had hesitated before agreeing that, for now, she might serve as a substitute. No doubt her lower salary had also factored into his decision. It had all seemed so easy at the time, but her hope had faded fast. She'd plateaued early and hadn't been able to move up since. No increase in commissions, possibly no class to teach next term, and no fashion magazine cover. A shuffling sound brought Clara back to earth, back to where she stood in front of an easel at the Grand Central School of Art, her painting finished. She turned around to see the entire class clustered behind her, Levon at the fore, his arms crossed. She had no idea how long they'd all been standing there. But she knew, from the way his eyes traveled over her painting, from the right shoulder to the detail of the left foot and back up, that she'd more than held her own. The assignment in Levon's class freed Clara from her recent gloom. She couldn't explain it, other than she'd regained a touch of confidence that her time in New York had steadily eroded. Her brashness had gotten her through doors, but beneath it all had been a desperation to succeed at all costs, and pushing that hard had caused her to stall, just like her father's decrepit Model T used to do. He'd kick the tires and curse while she waited inside, cocooned in the tufted leather seat. Levon's assignment had forced her to dig deep back into her creative well and do something unusual. Draw for the sake of beauty. It wasn't about accurately capturing the curve of a leather T-strap, but the curve from waist to hip, the simple beauty of the human form. In any event, the few hours in Levon's class had offered her a reprieve from her impending financial doom. In front of his students, Levon had pointed out how she'd captured the model's character, not just his construction.
"Do you see the romance, the spirit, the fine truth?"
They'd all nodded, as Clara stood by, squashing any outward sign of satisfaction. At the end of class, she'd hovered, hoping to thank Levon for his graciousness. But he'd been corralled by a student in the far corner, and she'd left without a word. Oliver had dashed the moment the students had been told to put down their brushes. Thank God, for she didn't think she'd be able to look him in the eyes without blushing. Over the weekend, the news of the bet had spread throughout the school, and she'd arrived at her illustration class heady with expectation, yet Levon lumbered in late, shaking the hands of the students he knew like a polished politician. She watched with irritation as her tiny class fell under his spell. Levon seemed to think that he could charm his way to a win.
"I'm sorry to be late. My apologies to our venerated professor."
Gertrude giggled. "You may take any drawing table you like," offered Clara.
"So many to choose from."
He wandered about, taking his time, as if selecting the best seat in a restaurant. The man took up too much room, not because of his height or build, but because he simply demanded more attention than anyone else, which was saying a lot in a school for artists. Clara ignored his overacting and continued describing the day's assignment. "I'd like you to take a close look at Renoir's Luncheon of the Boating Party." She placed a print of it on an easel and slid it forward. The work was one of her favorites. The way Renoir had captured the flirtation of youth, hands almost touching, languorous looks, a man with bare arms straddling a chair. The heat of a summer's day seemed to rise from the painting's surface. "You're to rework this to the modern day and place a bottle of Coca-Cola in one of the subject's hands." A murmur went around the room. Gertrude spoke up.
"Do we have to recreate the entire composition?"
"No, you can narrow down your focus to whichever character or group appeals most to you." Levon stood.
"You cannot be serious."
"I am serious. If you want to focus on only one character, I understand." He gasped a couple of times, like a fish on a hook. If he had gills, they'd be fanning themselves madly. This was far easier than she imagined.
"This is blasphemy. You're defiling a master. You can't ask your students to do this. It's not dignified."
"It sells soda."
"No, it doesn't. This is a class, not the real world."
"For illustrators, there is no delineation. They may be asked to do something like this, so they might as well get used to it." She paused. "You're lucky I didn't choose Les Demoiselles d'Avignon." At the mention of his beloved Picasso, Levon almost levitated off the floor.
"If you'd chosen that, I would have walked right out that door."
"And you would have lost the bet. Now, class, please get to work." For some time, there was no sound other than pencils scribbling away, followed by the soft whoosh of brush on paper. Wilbur, true to form, grumbled every so often, but the girls stayed focused on the task at hand. "Watercolor is like a performance," she said, speaking to no one in particular. The wash is constantly changing, drying with every passing minute, and you must be able to move quickly. Make a large field fast if you want the color to be consistent. The preparation, the right brush, the right amount of wash, the correct mix of colors is key. But you must work with speed and confidence. Levon lit a cigarette and sat back in his chair, gazing up at the ceiling. She ignored him and watched over Gertrude's shoulder as she painted the orange flower on the woman's hat. "Flowers are certainly your forte, Gertrude." The girl smiled.
"They're my favorite."
Levon stubbed out his cigarette and leaned over the drawing board, pencil in hand. He drew a few quick strokes before leaping up and leaving the room. Was he throwing the bet? She sidled over and looked at his paper, where he'd deftly captured the figure of the man straddling the chair. But he hadn't opened up one jar of paint yet. She checked her watch. He had plenty of time. What if he regretted the wager, of using her as his model? It had certainly been an impulsive declaration. What if, upon further thought, he'd come to the conclusion it would be a waste of time? Clara wasn't a typical model. "A pair of large feet and hands attached to a string bean," her mother used to say. Levon returned 10 minutes later, took his seat, and picked up a brush. What did it matter what his motives were? She hardly knew him at all, and this bet was a means to an end. Much of Clara's time was spent with Wilbur, helping him attain the flesh-colored tone of the faces. Finally, the bell sounded for the end of class. Levon squirmed in his chair, stood, and put on his coat. Clara walked over to his table, standing as tall as she possibly could, her spine long and stiff, and looked down at the paper. The other students, curious, gathered around her. He'd made so many mistakes, she didn't know where to begin. His impatience with the amount of time it took for one color to dry before working on the adjacent hue meant that they'd bled into one another, forming what seemed to be a hazy sunset, not a human being. The bottle of Coca-Cola looked like a bouquet of roses that had wilted in the heat. No advertiser would accept this. Her own students had done much better jobs. And he hadn't thrown the bet. He was red-faced, fuming, and silent. "Interesting," she couldn't help herself. "An unusual approach." He twirled about, grabbing the paper and ripping it in half. "Watercolor is a child's medium." She tried and failed to keep a satisfied smile from spreading across her face. "So you'll speak with Mr. Lorat in the morning?" He took a deep breath and gave her the slightest nod before storming off. She'd won. Chapter 5, November 1974. Virginia ran as fast as her high heels could take her, away from the three men huddled together in the seventh-floor hallway of Grand Central. They yelled after her, calling her terrible names. She took the corner fast, slamming her knee into the opposite wall. A door a few yards away opened slowly, and she slid to a stop. One of them must have taken a shortcut, knowing she'd never make it to the elevator in time. It was over. But instead of a thug, the lawyer from this morning emerged. Mr. Huckle. He was wiping down his hands with a paper towel on his way out of the men's room. He looked as shocked to see her as she did him. He looked past her to her pursuers, and in a split second, his entire visage changed. He stood up, tall, huge, in fact. She hadn't noticed how enormous he was back in his office, surrounded by all the papers and books. He filled the narrow hallway like a boulder in a crevice. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" he bellowed. Virginia ducked behind him, not sure if she should stay put or make a run for the elevator.
We're cool, man. Just trying to help out a lost lady.
The three men began backing up almost immediately. Now that she had a chance to study them, she could see they were teenagers with acne over pallid skin, raging with testosterone-fueled bluster. She imagined Mr. Huckle barreling toward them, a bowling ball aimed at three skinny pins.
They were going to attack me, whispered Virginia.
Mr. Huckle glanced around at her.
Stay put. Don't move.
One of the men swore.
We're going, we're going. Don't get all bent out of shape. You're going to be bent out of shape by the time I'm done with you. Get the hell out of here before I call the cops.
After they'd turned the corner, out of view, Mr. Huckle put a protective arm around Virginia. It felt heavy but good.
Are you all right? Did they hurt you?
She shook her head.
You appeared just in time.
We better get out of here. Follow me.
He led her down the hall, around another corner. By now she was completely turned around, until they reached the door to the legal department.
What are you doing wandering around up here? Everything's empty, closed up in this section.
I took the wrong elevator trying to get back to my coat. I left it in the closet.
The shock of what she'd just been through hit home now that she was in the fluorescent lights of the offices, somewhere safe. Her mind replayed the scene in her head, the dank smell of the hallway, the shininess of their black leather jackets. Her head felt foggy. What was she supposed to do now?
Get out of here.
Virginia slid her coat off the hanger.
What were you doing here all day? Asked Mr. Huckle. I didn't see you.
Kathleen sent me down to the information booth.
Did she? He frowned.
Yes, since we didn't work out. I'm sorry about that, by the way, Mr. Huckle.
She turned to leave.
Call me Dennis. You shouldn't go out there alone. In fact, we should go to the police and report these guys. I don't like the idea of them wandering around up here with the other office workers. Let's go down and we'll make a report, see if we can actually get them to do their jobs in this hellhole.
She looked at her watch. She was supposed to meet her friend Betsy in an hour. But if she didn't do anything, her would-be attackers might waltz past the information booth one day and spot her. She was safe with Dennis. Nothing was going to happen to her as long as he was nearby. So she might as well keep him nearby for as long as possible. They took the elevator down to the mezzanine level and walked through a set of doors with the words "To Vanderbilt Avenue, the Campbell Apartment," etched in the marble above them. He cut a sharp left, and she followed him up a narrow set of stairs. The placard on the door read, "Metro North Police." Dennis greeted a man in a blue uniform who sat beneath a row of television monitors, showing grainy black-and-white footage of train platforms. Cheap wood paneling divided the entryway from another, larger area behind him. In the smaller space, uneven shelves held files and binders, messier than in the information booth. Virginia stifled an impulse to straighten them out, clean up the messy piles. She hated to see disarray, which was why she avoided going into her daughter's bedroom as much as possible, where bell-bottoms and peasant tops were strewn about like the cast of hair had just cavorted by. A sliding window looked out into a holding pen. Inside, a couple of bums had arranged metal folding chairs as beds and were asleep, or more likely, passed out. One man groaned, and the police officer slammed the window shut.
"Dennis, what's going on?" asked the cop. "We had a problem up on 7. Couple of thugs tried to attack one of our employees."
He motioned to Virginia. The officer barely reacted. Just another day in the city.
Sorry to hear it. Let me call the sergeant, see if we can't have some guys go up and do a sweep. Hold on a sec.
He picked up the phone, spoke in a thick Brooklyn accent to someone on the receiving end.
They're on it. In the meantime, let me get you some paperwork to fill out. We'll see if we can catch these guys.
He looked around and swore.
Be right back.
When they were alone, Dennis looked down at her, a reassuring smile on his face. She pretended her neck itched, covering her right breast with her arm, her reflexive, protective gesture. Chester had hated when she did that. He'd tell her to sit up straight, stop worrying so much, that she looked fine. They'd lived what she thought was a wonderful life together, until he went to a party in the village one Friday night on a whim, dragged downtown by two winsome girls from the secretarial pool in his office. What he saw there, he said, opened his eyes to his own true nature. He didn't want to be pinned down anymore. He wanted his freedom instead. The timing of his ridiculous announcement, just a few years after her recovery, had left Virginia dizzy and breathless. He'd insisted it had nothing to do with her disfigurement, but she'd known better. He'd taken her to the Oyster Bar for dinner one night, probably on his way to some key party up in Connecticut, and told her it was over. She'd shielded herself with her arm, sat back in her chair and looked up at the vaulted ceiling, wondering if it would amplify her screams. But she hadn't screamed. Just looked at him, agreed, insisted that they tell Ruby together. Chester hadn't settled down with one woman, and for that she'd been grateful. She hadn't been replaced by a younger, prettier version. She'd heard through the grapevine that he'd cycled through dozens of girls and was living the high life.
Have some water.
Dennis reached over to the water cooler propped up in the corner, filled a paper cone, and handed it to her.
You okay?
I think I'm a little freaked out, to be honest. She took a sip, stifling a giggle. My daughter always tells me I have the wrong reaction to things, like laughing at a funeral, crying at a funny movie. My ex-husband would tell me that I tend to babble on when I'm nervous. Talk, 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 and sometimes hum. Boy, that drove him crazy, because I can't keep a tune. Or is it hold a tune? She was making a fool of herself.
Try me. Hum something, and let's see if I can recognize it.
Lips pursed, she launched into the chorus of Seasons in the Sun, which had been circling around her brain ever since it came out. Dennis listened, blinking with concentration.
Time in a bottle?
She shook her head. No, oh dear, it's that one about... She stopped herself mid-sentence. I'm sorry, I'm taking up so much of your time. You must want to get home to your family.
Don't worry about it. I'm divorced, so there's no rush to get back to my place in Yonkers.
Yonkers? She'd imagined him, like all the lawyers she knew, living on the Upper East Side or off in the distant suburbs.
Where my family's from originally. I live near my ma. Take care of her. Probably why I'm getting divorced, if you want to know the truth.
As he spoke, he rolled up his shirt sleeves, exposing thick forearms. She'd always been a sucker for a rolled-up sleeve on a man. Something about the thatch of short hairs against a crisp white shirt made her knees wobble. How did you become a lawyer?
Studied, got into City College, and then Fordham Law.
My ex-husband is a lawyer. Columbia. Even though they'd been divorced for a year, she still sometimes dropped that into conversation out of habit, as if they were still a unit and his accomplishments were synonymous with her own. Dennis didn't seem all that impressed, which made her like him more. How long have you been working for Penn Central?
Since I got out of law school. Started as an associate. With this lawsuit still pending against the Landmarks Commission, it's been crazy.
But there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Why is there a lawsuit?
The Landmarks Commission says that Penn Central has to keep the terminal exactly like it is, which is absurd. The place is a money pit. If all goes according to plan and we win this case, I'm going to be promoted to head of the department.
One of the guys in the holding cell began to moan. She wondered if the cop was ever going to come back. But in a way, she didn't mind. What's the big plan?
Once we shoot down the notion that the terminal is protected by landmark status, we're going to put up a new skyscraper on this very spot. 55 stories. It's going to be massive. The city will give us a huge tax write-off for improving the district, and we'll be making serious money from the rent. Much better than this old mausoleum.
He gestured around him. They'd tear it down? Like Penn Station? A little less than 10 years ago, she'd been as surprised as many others in the city to find that Penn Station, a glass jewel of a train hub, was to be demolished. The few voices raised in protest had made no difference.
The new building will rip through part of it, the side facing 42nd Street, and rest on top, like a hen sitting on its eggs.
To demonstrate, Dennis held out one hand in a fist and settled the other lightly on top of it. His fingernails were trimmed and clean. She studied the odd shape formed by Dennis's hands, unable to picture what he described. A couple of years ago, Betsy had insisted Virginia join her in signing up for the Ladies' Committee to preserve Old New York, or Pony, as it was known. They met in a member's over-decorated living room once a month and listened to a guest speaker, nodding with concern while getting buzzed on generous pours of rosé. The day of the Grand Central lecture, the historian described how Cornelius Vanderbilt constructed the original station, called Grand Central Depot, in 1871, and that the one that stood today was completed in 1913. He showed them photos of the pristine waiting room right after it was built, and the whispering gallery, where the unique design of the vaulted ceiling carried even the smallest sound to the opposite corner. The historian, surveying the room of tipsy wives, had proclaimed that women, in particular, should recall that whispers carry and can have tremendous power, even if their voices were weaker than a man's. Virginia wasn't sure if he was being encouraging or chauvinistic. Still, Grand Central had such a rich history. You're putting a modernist skyscraper on top of a Beaux-Arts building. Won't that look strange?
It's the future. The city's got to move forward. At the moment, there's a ton of empty space in here that's completely unusable. That's lost revenue for Penn Central.
Like the art school. She thought of Terrence and his clerks. What about the employees who work for the railroad?
Anything to do with the trains gets buried underground. The terminal goes down 10 stories, so there's a lot of room to play with. Next time you come up to my office, I'll show you a model of the new building. Incredible. Hey, if you play your cards right, I'll get you a cushy job.
As long as I don't have to do stenography. He laughed.
I'm sorry I was hard on you this morning.
Don't be sorry. I had no idea what I was doing. But I like this idea of a cushy job. I could answer phones, say. I'd be a great receptionist. She pretended to pick up a phone. Mr. Huckle's office, how may I help you?
I like that.
He stared at her a moment too long. He was flirting with her. The realization came with a rush of confusion. She hadn't flirted since 1953. How different he seemed now than when they'd first met 7 hours ago. But how could she ever consider being with another man? How would she talk about it? I had an operation.
What you see is not what you get. He'd laugh, thinking she was joking, and then he'd try to look concerned, all while trying to conceal his horror. The cop came back, and they filled out the paperwork describing the incident and the men they'd encountered. As she repeated the details, it became less a frightening experience and more a story, something that had happened and was over. She could handle almost being mugged. It had happened to almost everyone she knew at one time or another. It was amazing she'd avoided it for so long, being a lifelong New Yorker. Handling Dennis's flirtation, though, was truly scary. They signed the documents, and the cop said he'd make sure his guys patrolled the hallways regularly from now on. Dennis walked her to the taxi stand on Vanderbilt Avenue. She couldn't afford a cab, but she was running late to meet Betsy, and today, of all days, she deserved a little treat, a comfort that she took for granted all those years she was married. He opened the car door for her. "Thank you, Dennis." She avoided his eyes, tucked herself into the back seat. As the door shut, he called out,
"Hey, maybe I'll stop by and see you in the information booth tomorrow."
The cab pulled away before she could answer. When Betsy ordered the third round of martinis, Virginia knew it tripled her own odds of revealing the truth about her day. But she hadn't eaten since the street vendor's hot dog that afternoon, and the thought of three more olives in her belly was incentive enough.
"Oh my God, V, I've been blathering on."
Betsy jangled the wooden beads that hung around her neck.
"Tell me what you've been up to."
She had that strained look on her face that meant she was trying to focus, even though she was already buzzing from the gin. A few drops sloshed onto the already sticky bar as she brought the glass to her lips. They'd met years ago, when their husbands worked at the same firm. Both lived on the Upper East Side and had run into each other at corporate and school events over the past two decades. What they had in common was also what kept them from truly being friends. Humble beginnings. Virginia's home was a Hell's Kitchen tenement that she'd shared with her parents and younger brother. Betsy's a two-bedroom in Stuyvesant Town. They'd discussed it once and never again. A shameful secret. Betsy knew the drill as well as Virginia did. You kept certain things quiet for appearance's sake. Instead, they had attended barbecues in Greenwich and private dinners in four-star restaurants, and Betsy even began talking like the other ladies, as if her jaw had been wired shut. Virginia's own accent had been tempered as an underclassman at Barnard College. After meeting Chester at a Columbia mixer, she'd toned it down even further. As the fog from her post-divorce haze had cleared, she'd understood that what Betsy really wanted was the dirt. A detailed list of what had happened to send Virginia's life careening downward in order to avoid the same fate. When Betsy called last week to arrange a girls' night out, Virginia had eagerly agreed, knowing she'd be coming straight off her first day on the job. She'd imagined their meeting as the exclamation point on her new life as a successful working woman. Sticking with the script, she pasted a bright smile on her face.
"It's been a whirlwind. I started working at Penn Central this week, right in Grand Central Terminal. Can you imagine?"
Betsy frowned as she dabbed at the bar with a cocktail napkin.
"You're working now?"
Her lipstick matched her ruffled top, the color of orange sherbet, which she'd pulled down to expose her shoulders even though it was November.
"Ruby's quite independent, and I enjoy having a sense of purpose in life."
"I haven't been to Grand Central in ages, because we take the car up to North Salem on weekends, but I hear it's ghastly these days."
"The building's seen better days, but the office is quite grand. You take an elevator right up, so you don't see any of the street people. Perfectly safe."
So far, so good. Especially learning that Betsy and Cliff rarely use the train. Less chance of being discovered. Cliff's seriously considering that we move out of the city. I don't blame him. Betsy rummaged through her bag, placing her wallet, a tube of lipstick, and a small book on the bar before locating her compact. The other day, I noticed graffiti on 825th Avenue, that grand building marred by spray paint. Horrible people running around. She checked her appearance, clicked the compact shut, and swept everything.